This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, author and sociology professor Alex Vitale joins us to talk about his new book, The End of Policing.
Policemen are tasked with jobs that they really shouldn't be doing as cops. They don't like it. We don't like it. There's been no success. His proposals are radical on what to do to end policing.
As part of our Lawyers You'll Like series, we speak with Michelle Lewin of the Parole Preparation Project.
If you're in prison and you want to get out on parole, you got a tough job, but you'll get some help from Michelle's people. Listen to what they do.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. The recent book, The End of Policing, by New York professor Alex Vitale, feels especially timely right now. Burgeoning grassroots movements, such as those in response to police violence in Ferguson, Missouri, have drawn attention to the increased militarization of law enforcement in the treatment of civilians, and have helped to raise public awareness of failed policing policies. Yet no amount of media exposure has seemed to result in any workable solutions to systemic violence. Vitale has written an immensely readable and thorough chronology of the origins of modern policing as a tool of social control. He reveals how increased police authority is incompatible with social justice and community empowerment, and perhaps more surprisingly, is ineffective in terms of public safety. Kirkus Reviews calls the book a tightly constructed monograph filled with reform suggestions that is a clearly argued, sure-to-be-controversial book. Vitale cites research from around the globe to show how law enforcement, rather than help with an array of social problems, is actually making things worse. Vitale offers suggestions for several alternatives to policing that he thinks will be more effective in attaining social justice and safety goals. Alex Vitale is an associate professor of sociology at Brooklyn College. He's also author of the book City of Disorder, How the Quality of Life Campaign Transformed New York Politics. He is senior advisor to the Police Reform Organizing Project and serves as the New York State Advisory Committee to the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. Alex, welcome to Law and Disorder.
My pleasure.
As a professor of sociology, much of your work is focused on policing. How did you initially become interested in this field?
Well, I was actually not working in academia. I was working for the San Francisco Coalition on Homelessness in the late 80s and early 90s on housing policy, which is what I'd studied in school and community development. And a lot of the homeless folks that we were working with were coming in complaining about being harassed. My boss at the time, Paul Bowden, asked me to go out and take a look at what was going on. And basically, that was the early stages of broken windows policing. And I got pulled into dealing with that and spent a number of years working with the ACLU and other groups pushing back. And then decided to go back to school, came to New York in 93, just as Giuliani gets elected, and then see the whole thing play out again. So I wrote a dissertation about the rise of quality of life policing in the two cities and the politics around that, wrote a book called City of Disorder, and, you know, got pulled more and more into these debates about the relationship between policing and urban politics, and that brings us to today.
And your timing was right on.
For our listeners outside the New York City area, broken windows policing was instituted here in New York City, and no longer, thankfully. But tell us what that is.
Well, I wouldn't say no longer. I mean, the mayor has said rhetorically he's totally committed to broken windows policing, so it remains a major factor shaping the police instituting lots of low-level arrests, ticketing, et cetera, focus on very minor disorderly behavior in the claimed belief that this will somehow miraculously reduce the homicide rate and revitalize neighborhoods, etc.
Cleaning up graffiti, getting rid of squeegee persons, a lot of this harkened back to Giuliani.
That's correct.
As you've noted.
Yeah.
Alex, we want to congratulate you on your new book, The End of Policing.
Thank you.
And we, of course, were especially interested in your chapter on political policing. So, well, we're going to ask you about the rest of the book. We wanted to start with that. And I noted that in addition to your citing practices in different countries, you drew parallels, or we saw parallels in how the British police monitor domestic political movements. And you've included some shocking examples that we've mentioned on the show before, but we'd like to hear a little bit more about them. Tell us about British practices and how they relate to U.S. practices.
Well, I think the first thing to keep in mind here is that the history of policing is a history of political policing. That policing basically exists to solve a set of political problems. And those problems in the early and mid-19th century, when we begin to get police forces, are the problems of managing these different exploitative regimes of accumulation, if you will, colonialism, slavery, and the formation and management of a new urban industrial workforce. And the book traces those trajectories and looks at how that shapes early policing. So in addition to the kind of general sense in which policing is a political project, police have always been involved directly in the suppression, management, supervision, surveillance of social movements, whether they're colonial resistance mechanisms, preventing slave uprisings, the suppression of workers' movements. Here in New York, we had the Italian Squad, the Anarchist Squad, the Red Squad, you know. And this kind of policing always happens under the surface. And one of the things I learned in looking at this internationally and historically is that it also always involves a kind of corrupt relationship with private interests, so that there's what the government, what the state has the police doing, but it's always done in conjunction with powerful economic interests. So, for instance, police would often get under the table payments for successfully breaking up a strike, or police would gather intelligence on people and then turn the names over to private groups who would go out and intimidate employers and try to get people fired. Or conversely, private groups would go out and collect names and turn that over to the police, who would then share it with other agencies, etc. So this pattern is fairly consistent in the U.S. and the U.K. in colonial centers. I looked at how the U.K. policing of India was carried out, for instance, during the colonial occupation there. And so what we see in the UK is the targeting of non-criminal, mostly peaceful movements, breaking into offices, suppressing newspapers, harassing and surveilling people. And this is throughout the last, 180-year history of policing there.
We have to mention the agents provocateurs who infiltrated environmental groups and formed romantic relationships, often for a period of years, and including having children with the women they were monitoring in Great Britain.
Yeah, in the UK, this is referred to generally as the spy cops scandal, and it's an ongoing issue. Investigations remain underway, and as well as lawsuits against the police. You had a variety of things going on, but basically this involved undercover officers infiltrating groups, often engaging in or encouraging others to engage in property destruction, such as, damaging department stores to gain credibility within the animal rights movement, and also to provide an ongoing need to have this kind of political policing. But the most disturbing thing is that in the effort to maintain their cover, and I put that in quotation marks, officers, undercover officers, under false pretenses, engaged in romantic relationships, produced children with activists, with no real consequences and no real oversight. So it's horrible. We had somewhat similar analogies in the U.S. during the 60s and 70s with COINTELPRO and the widespread use of both undercover agents and paid informants who actively subverted groups and engaged in provocations of various kinds. But we haven't, fortunately, as far as we know, seen quite that level of scandal in the U.S., The closest thing here to home was the recent revelation that the NYPD is part of their totally unwarranted spying on Muslim and Arab communities. Also sent undercover officers into social settings, mosques, and college campuses. And at my own school, Brooklyn College, we learned that an undercover officer was posing as a member of Islamic student associations, going to their homes, attending weddings, and eventually was outed because of her involvement in another criminal case, and students realized this person they thought was their close personal friend was actually a police officer.
Alex, you've just referenced cooperation between public policing and private interest. And we know the history of the Pinkertons and private policing in the United States. I gather you weren't surprised to see a return to something similar, that's contracting and the formation of fusion centers in which information is shared between the private sector and the public.
Yeah, well, you know, this history is also part of my family history. My family were coal miners going back 75 years or so in southern Illinois. So I grew up with some of these stories about strike breakers and even the Ku Klux Klan attacking the immigrant communities that my family lived in at that time. So I was very sort of intuitively aware of these connections, but it's certainly this kind of corrupt relationship with private interests, it could be seen more recently in the handling of the Occupy movement.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. Talk about that.
Yeah,
please.
So one of the things we know, and we don't know as much as we'd like to know because these things are always cloaked in secrecy, is one of the things we know is that there was a tremendous amount of intelligence sharing between the targets of Occupy, the banks and financial institutions, and local and federal police agencies.
They shared an office.
Well, sometimes this is done through these fusion centers that are created in the wake of 9/11 that are supposed to help coordinate intelligence gathering to do threat assessments around terrorism. But what they quickly found is that there was nothing to do on that front or very little, and so it was changed to a kind of all threats. So basically they were given free rein to work on whatever they wanted to, and what that generally ends up looking like is a lot of intelligence gathering on totally peaceful and lawful political activity. And especially the more contentious, confrontational, and effective it is, the more surveillance, the more attention, the more information sharing that goes on.
Alex, you referenced the term Red Squads earlier. Can you remind our listeners what those are? And I was unaware that they drew so heavily in history on volunteers.
That's right. So we sometimes think about political policing as like the FBI, and of course J. Edgar Hoover develops many of the techniques that become standard practice in policing. But policing in the U.S. is primarily a local phenomenon. You know, there are more NYPD personnel than there are federal law enforcement of all kinds. So the FBI could never carry out this kind of political surveillance on its own. And in fact, at times Congress pushed back. There were scandals like during the Church Commission eras. But even before this, there was some congressional pushback on Hoover and the extent of political policing. And so much of that work fell to local police departments, especially big city departments in Chicago, Los Angeles, New York, each of which developed red squads of some kind. These are usually off-the-book operations where people are gathering intelligence files, infiltrating organizations, and in some cases engaging in direct acts of subversion. And often this is done with the cooperation of local interest groups. So, you know, anti-immigrant groups, anti-communist groups, the Catholic League, etc., provide a lot of additional manpower, so to speak, to go out and collect this intelligence, but also to engage in the kind of dirty tricks, breaking up meetings, and these kinds of things.
When I had a law firm in Detroit in the 60s, the Red Squad, which is what they called themselves, and they listed our law firm as MO, our method of operation was being a lawyer, and they used to break into our office. We didn't know it at the time until Freedom of Information Act request showed that they did. But our burglar alarm would go off. We didn't know why, and they would come into our office, go through our files on our clients. And I suspect that this stuff is still going on. I was alarmed to learn that the FBI now has what they call a Black Identity Extremist Project, which sounds to me like COINTELPRO reinvented.
Yes, well, it's certainly alarming to hear that. It's hard to know with this administration in particular what is theater and what is like actually going on. You know, they've declared like an emergency around opioids, but have actually done absolutely nothing about it. So we don't, and then of course, again, as I said, these things tend to be cloaked in secrecy. So certainly it's alarming. We should be deeply skeptical and we should demand transparency. There's absolutely no evidence that these groups are engaged in dangerous criminal activity, and so there should be no basis for any kind of ongoing intelligence gathering, populating of files, enhanced or even generic surveillance. So I think one of the things we want to do to fight political policing is at every stage demand more transparency. Demand that civilian monitors be inserted into these police departments with the ability to have access to files, to find out where these off-the-books operations are, etc.
In addition to the chapter on the policing of political entities, and as you say, that really informs the whole raison d'etre for police, we wanted to talk about some of additional reforms that you've recommended. And I know that Michael had some other questions about the rest of the book because you cover so many interesting areas.
Yeah, a number of reforms that you've suggested, Alex, include more training, diversity, enhanced accountability, independent prosecutor, federal intervention, body cameras, and you present other alternatives. What's wrong with limiting ourselves to just these reforms?
Right. So I don't propose these reforms. I reject these reforms, just to be clear about this, that the policing in the U.S. is in a crisis of legitimacy, and the standard liberal response to that is to take a series of reform steps to try to reestablish that legitimacy while never actually addressing the underlying problematic nature of policing, and especially in its expanded role over the last 40 years. So let's just take a few of these. Yeah, it seems very appealing, the idea to diversify police forces, but there's absolutely no evidence to show that this produces better outcomes. In fact, some research shows that it produces worse outcomes, higher arrest rates, etc. And we have police departments around the country in places that do look a lot like the communities that they police, and it just makes no difference. It may make the community feel better, although actually most of the research shows it doesn't even do that, but it does not affect the basic mission of policing. So another area, and one of the ones that I find really problematic, is implicit bias training. So this is a way for local political and police leaders to give the appearance that they're doing something about race while doing absolutely nothing. This is based on fundamentally problematic research about split-second unconscious reaction times based on racial differences that's not reproducible, but more importantly, has never been shown to fundamentally affect behavior. And furthermore, it assumes that the racialized problems in policing are unconscious, when in fact it's often quite explicit and conscious. Whenever we look for racism in policing, we find it. But even if there isn't individualized bias among individual officers, the whole project of policing as conceptualized reproduces racial inequality because it assumes that certain kinds of communities need punishment and coercion while other kinds of communities don't. And that choice of communities has to do with both racial bias and the fact that we start from such radically different starting points because of our legacies of racial exploitation. So until we do something about these fundamental missions of policing, tinkering with the training and a few procedural changes is not going to affect the substantively unjust outcomes.
My nephew, Ben Elson, is in the Police Accountability Project of the National Lawyers Guild. He is a partner at the People's Law Office in Chicago. So they litigate police abuse cases. They've been doing it for 40 years. And after a couple of years, Ben said to me, you know, getting into this, there's really no solution. There's no solution other than really a fundamental change in the way the society is organized and who gets what. That was his conclusion, that there's really no reforms that you can do that are going to be effective. And I think that that's what you arrive at in your book, The End of Policing.
Well, he's dealing with especially, I think, the accountability side. Can we get the officers fired? Can we get them prosecuted? Can we get legal judgments against them? Can we get consent decrees? Can we get settlement agreements with some change? And there's just no evidence that any of this makes any lasting changes. Sometimes there's a short-term treatment effect where because you've done something dramatic, there's a shaking out period and things look better, but then police departments revert to type. In part because the fundamental mission remains unchanged. When we ask police to wage a war on crime, a war on drugs, a war on terror, a war on disorder, you know, they're going to produce really unjust outcomes. They can't do those things and be nice and respectful and be under the control of communities, et cetera. So any efforts to do those things are just doomed to failure.
So what do you propose in your book if these things don't work? What's the answer? How should we be looking at this?
So what I do in the book is I take eight areas of policing that make up a huge amount of what police do, and I show the kind of rancid history of those forms of policing, their roots in racism, nativism, xenophobia, and I show how liberal reforms are not going to change these things. And I say what we need to do is we need to instead choose complete alternatives to relying on police. So we don't need nicer school police. We don't need school police to be better trained. We don't need school police to be mentors to young people. We need to get rid of school policing. It's a terrible idea. We need restorative justice programs in the schools. We need more counselors. We need community schools models. So I lay out the concrete alternatives in every chapter. We don't need a more professional, unbiased war on drugs. We don't need to like arrest more drug users on Wall Street to make it even and unbiased. The war on drugs is a horrible, racist idea that has never had anything to do with public health or public safety, and it should be abolished.
Alex, you've received high praise for your book, and justifiably so. I noted that Kirkus Review said this was a sure-to-be controversial book. Have you received negative feedback on it?
Not really. It's very interesting. Everyone asked me, when is the pushback coming?
Right.
A lot of liberal reformers, people who are engaged in promoting a lot of these reforms that I call into question, I think so far preferred a strategy of let's ignore it and hopefully it'll go away. The only feedback I've gotten from police has been positive. And there's just a long review in the John Jay College magazine by a career NYPD officer who was involved in training and strategic planning that said it was the best book he'd read on criminal justice issues in his career, that
he'd done
all these things and seen the utter futility. He said, except for like border policing, I've done everything in the book, and these are all a terrible idea, and you've laid out the real concrete alternatives to doing them. And I have a number of invitations in the UK. This has been released pretty widely in Europe. And police there are reading it in fairly large numbers because they're afraid that American policing is coming there and they don't want it.
And let's talk about that briefly. What would that mean? Would it mean more weaponized officers there?
It would mean that, but it would mean this kind of broad expansion of the scope of policing. That in the U.S. we've decided that every problem in the sun should be solved by police, especially if it involves poor people and people of color. And in the U.K. they've resisted some of this. They don't respond to mental health crisis calls. They don't have school police. They don't wage the war on drugs in the same way we do here. And so they don't produce a lot of the problems. You know, over a quarter of all people killed by police in the United States are having a mental health crisis at the time they're killed. It's totally outrageous. And the police should have nothing to do with it.
So that's heartening news. Perhaps this might be widely adopted by law enforcement, and that gives you added ammunition, as it were.
Well, I don't know about widely adopted, but I think it's, you know, it's having an impact. I know there are police here in the U.S. that are reading it, that are engaging it. But in a way, the target audience for this ultimately is not the police, because they didn't invent the war on drugs. They didn't close down the mental health system. They didn't divest from the schools and create charter schools and high-stakes testing. These were political decisions. And part of the problem with the police accountability movement is that it lets the political leadership off the hook too often. And we need to redirect a lot of that energy into political accountability. Why have we asked the police to do all these things that often they don't want to do? There's a quote in the book from Chief Brown, who was in Dallas when the officers were killed, and he's like, every problem in Dallas, they try to put it off on us. The schools don't work. Give it to the cops. The mental health system has collapsed. Give it to the cops. We got a loose dog problem. Give it to the cops. You know, we can't do all these things. It's a terrible idea.
Your book is well written, and there were a number of passages that struck me that I thought would be worth reading out loud. And I wondered whether you had a favorite passage that you could share with us.
There is one in the conclusion that I think you noticed that I could just read a quick paragraph from.
Thank you.
This does not mean that no one should articulate or fight for reforms. However, those reforms must be part of a larger vision that questions the basic role of police in society and asks whether coercive government action will bring more justice or less. Too many of the reforms under discussion today fail to do this. Many further empower the police and expand their role. Community policing, body cameras, and increased money for training reinforce a false sense of police legitimacy and expand the reach of the police into communities and private lives. More money, more technology, and more power and influence will not reduce the burden or increase the justness of policing. Ending the war on drugs, abolishing school police, ending broken windows policing, developing robust mental health care, and creating low-income housing systems will do much more to reduce abusive policing.
This is one of the best-written books that I've read in a long time. You're clear, lucid. There's research cited, but it's not too academic, so kudos on a great job.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you, Alex.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
In response to requests from people at Otisville Correctional Facility in upstate New York, nearly 5 years ago, the National Lawyers Guild held a training for volunteers interested in participating in a parole preparation project. The project's goals were to pair volunteers, law students, social workers, family, and friends of incarcerated persons, among others, with individuals who face long prison sentences and have been repeatedly denied parole. Today, the Parole Preparation Project is a flourishing nonprofit organization, in large part due to the efforts of its executive director, Michelle Lewin. Volunteers collaborate with parole applicants in New York State to gather necessary documentation for upcoming parole hearings and work with them on practicing for the actual interview. Volunteers also assist prisoners in soliciting meaningful letters of support from friends, family, and coworkers. Joining us today for a Lawyers You'll Like segment is attorney Michelle Lewin. Prior to co-founding and heading the Parole Preparation Project, Michelle was a court advocate at the Fortune Society. She also co-directed the Right to Write program at the Westchester County Correctional Center. Michelle Lewin, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Michelle, you've taken the path less traveled in law, namely working on behalf of prisoners' rights. How and why did you come to be interested in this area?
Well, when I was an undergrad, I was actually working in Westchester County Jail in Valhalla, and I started working with women inside teaching writing and doing some collaborative curriculum building. And I think, you know, once you start to work with people in jail and in prisons and you start to build relationships with people inside and with their families, you start to become exposed to the injustices, right, that are happening on a daily basis inside jails and inside prisons. You see people being brutalized. You see people suffering in really profound ways. And I think my work really started there, and it started to grow after that. I worked at the Fortune Society after I graduated from college, and I was working with people who were facing very long prison sentences for felonies that they had been convicted of or were about to be convicted of. And yeah, I think the deeper that I got into the work, I think the more and more apparent it became to me just how horrific the system really is and how devastating it is on people's families, on people's lives. You know, I think prisons and jails are, in a lot of ways, kind of the epicenter, you know, of so many enormous systems of oppression, whether it's white supremacy, whether it's, you know, anti-blackness, whatever it may be. You know, I think it's this big intersection of all of those devastating systems. And so I think for me, in a lot of ways, it feels like there's no other work I could be doing.
Few people really give much thought to our parole system. Talk, if you will, about the parole system in New York State and what some of the problems with it are.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is right now, you know, such an enormous conversation happening around this so-called, you know, crisis of mass incarceration. And I think there's a lot of focus on policing, a lot of focus on prosecution, and rightfully so. I think those parts of the system are deeply flawed. But and flawed is an understatement. I mean, I think, you know, devastating to the people entrenched in the system. And when we're talking about parole, right, we're talking about the system by which people are able to get release from prison. You know, there's two kinds of parole, right? There's the parole release supervision that people are on when they get released from prison, but there's also the parole experience that people have to go through when they're trying to actually obtain release from prison, right? So you have people who are serving time in New York State prisons who are serving indeterminate sentences, right? They're serving this range of a sentence. So it's somewhere between 5 and 10 years or, you know, 10 years to 25 years. Or
so wait, are you saying that some people go in and they don't know the exact number of years they're going to be inside?
Exactly, exactly. So for the people that I work with, they're serving sentences of usually either 15 years to life or 25 years to life, which means that at that minimum number, that 15 years or that 25 years, they become eligible for parole. They become eligible, you know, to be released into the community. But they can be denied, and oftentimes they are. So in New York State, there's a body called the Board of Parole, which is made up of parole commissioners who are responsible for making release determinations about this group of people who are serving indeterminate sentences.
Let's just clarify here. In a way, it then sounds to us that this board is serving almost like a sentencing judge.
That's exactly right. I, you know, in New York State, basically what happens is you could have a sentence of 15 years to life or 25 years to life, but for the vast majority of people serving these really long sentences, they end up serving 30 or 40 years in total, right? Because the parole board is sort of notoriously very tough on crime, very punitive in its approach. I mean, it's very invested in keeping people in prison. So even if a judge says, you know, I think you should be sentenced to 15 years to life, people are languishing for decades longer because the parole board has essentially taken on the role of resentencing people, exactly like you were saying.
Let's talk briefly about the composition of this board. Are there law enforcement officials on it?
Yeah, so the board is primarily former prosecutors, law enforcement, and people with no experience whatsoever in the criminal legal system, right? It's people who don't have backgrounds in therapeutic work or in social work, people who really do not reflect the identities or experiences of people in prison. You know, it's predominantly white, predominantly male. And I think that's a huge issue, right, in our work, is people are going before a board that really has absolutely no experience in dealing with the trauma of incarceration, the trauma of crime and violence, and they're making the decisions about people's lives and about people's freedom.
I understand that the Parole Preparation Project, where you are the executive director and you were a founder of that project, has undertaken advocacy on behalf of reforming the parole board. You've had some success in that?
Yeah, we did. In 2017, five of the commissioners whose terms were expiring that year were essentially up for reappointment. You know, the governor in New York State is responsible for appointing and reappointing parole commissioners, and the Senate is responsible for confirming those appointments and reappointments. And our feeling was is that some of those commissioners who were up for reappointment, who were notorious for denying people release based on the nature of their crime, should not be reappointed. Our position was that we wanted people on the board who were oriented towards the experiences of people in prison and had deep empathy and sympathy for what had happened to people during their incarceration and the transformation that people had undergone. So we were able to get some of those commissioners off the board and get six new commissioners onto the board.
Michelle, my understanding of the problem with the parole board, although I know that there has been some changes and a little better now than it used to be, but nevertheless, the parole board tends to look at the crime, something that will never change, and ignores what the applicant has done to improve himself or herself. Has that been a problem over the years, or is that something new?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question. I mean, I think you hit on the issue exactly, right, is that the board and the commissioners on the board are so fixated on the nature of the crime, right, this thing that will never change, this thing that happened oftentimes decades ago. And, you know, there have been legislative push in 2011. There were some reforms in terms of the executive law that governs parole that really sort of insisted that the board needed to consider people's rehabilitation and needed to consider their risk to society as opposed to the nature of their crime. And I think the judiciary also has pushed really hard in different ways for the board to consider rehabilitation as a primary factor. But I think a lot of these commissioners, especially the ones kind of left over from the Pataki era, are, you know, really pushing back and continue to push back against that pressure.
What kind of things can a applicant for parole show that she has done to be deserving of parole? What do you folks do to try to help them make that presentation in the most effective way?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a combination of two things. One, it's about submitting written materials to the board that demonstrate all of the accomplishments, the many, many accomplishments that the person has done, whether it's education or programming or, you know, therapeutic groups that they've participated in or that they've even started and initiated themselves. And then it's also preparing for the actual interview itself in front of the commissioners. You know, the interview process and the interview structure is difficult. It's an obstacle for a lot of people. It happens over video conference for the most part. It's not in person,
video
conference, right? Using technology that a lot of people who've been in prison have not been exposed to. You know, if they've been in for 30 or 40 years, right, a video screen, I mean, not only is it impersonal to begin with, but, you know, it's unfamiliar. And oftentimes, you know, it's just three commissioners appearing, you know, on the screen. But sometimes, you know, I hear stories of, you know, applicants only being able to see one commissioner at a time and not being able to see the other people in the room. And the interviews last, you know, somewhere between 5, 10, 15 minutes.
So you sit in prison for 5 years, and then you get 5 minutes to take a shot at getting out?
Yeah. I mean, I think I've seen increases in the times that hearings have lasted over the last maybe 6 months. And the truth is that the only kind of recourse you have is to say, okay, you know, this hearing wasn't just and this hearing didn't feel fair. Excuse me. And if somebody is able to actually successfully appeal the process, they only get a new hearing, right? So you're kind of trapped in this system.
The basic injustice in even allowing that board to consider the nature of the crime, because each individual has already had their day in court and been sentenced. It seems as though this is double punishment.
That's sort of our feeling as the advocacy community. People have done their time and they have done incredible things while incarcerated. They're, you know, scholars and educators and mentors and incredible jailhouse lawyers, and that they would be assets to the community, right? That we need people inside who have done so much work and so much self-reflection to come home and be part of our community and be here out with us, you know, organizing and mobilizing and doing all of this important work.
Let's talk about the really hard issue, and that is violent crime. Because the people that you're helping are people who are serving 15 years to life or 25 years to life. These are people who've done murder and other scary crimes. How do you answer critics who say, we can't let these people out. Look how dangerous they are. Are they?
I'm so glad you asked that question. I mean, I think that, you know, there's kind of this fixation, I think, around this question of mass incarceration with people convicted of nonviolent crime. There's this feeling if we just let everybody out who's been convicted of drug crimes and let everybody out who's been convicted of nonviolent crimes, that we would have a sort of adequate and acceptable, you know, number of people in prison. And that's actually not true. Almost 75% of people in New York State prisons are convicted of a violent crime. And so I think if we're serious about addressing mass incarceration, if we're serious about, addressing, you know, the injustices inherent in the system, we have to talk about violence. We have to talk about what it means. And I think my position and my feeling is that no person should ever be defined by the worst thing they've ever done, right? That every single person is capable of transformation, is capable of becoming a person who can live in community and live in harmony with other people. And I also think it's important to note, too, right? People who have served decades in prison pose no risk to public safety. They've aged out of crime. The recidivism rate for people convicted of murder is almost zero. You know, it's really not, I think, a question of whether or not people pose a risk, but why isn't the board releasing people who are so obviously ready to return home?
Michelle, you have written a law review article called Collaborating Across the Walls, about a community approach to parole justice. What might a community approach look like, and what are the key elements that you recommend?
I think a community approach to parole justice is one that incorporates people and is led by people who are formerly incarcerated and their loved ones, right? Is led by people who are directly impacted by the system, directly impacted by parole, and is really guided by their visions, their voices, their expertise, their experiences. You know, I see myself as an attorney and as an advocate as very much working at the service of and on behalf of people who are still inside and people who have come home. I feel like that's sort of the crucial element of a collaborative movement, and of a movement that prioritizes, you know, people who have direct experience with the system.
What reform efforts has the Parole Preparation Project undertaken, and with what measure of success?
Yeah, so we talked earlier about the Commissioner campaign and really wanting to redefine and restructure the composition of the parole board. And I think a big thing for us is really trying to get commissioners on the board who have backgrounds in social work, who have therapeutic experience. And then in addition to that, you know, there's a lot of legislative and advocacy efforts that we would like to see come into fruition, whether it's presumptive parole for elder people, presumptive parole for everybody who's reached their minimum, whether it's a revision of the executive law that governs parole, including removing the nature of the crime as a factor that can be considered. You know, there's so many different angles that I think we could take it from. And I think one big one, too, is finding attorneys to represent people on appeal for incarcerated people. So, yeah, there's a lot of work that needs to get done.
Michelle, I have the pleasure of sharing an office with you, along with Release Aging Persons in Prison, or RAP, who we've had on the show. Tell us how the Parole Preparation Project collaborates with other organizations in your work.
I mean, I think collaboration is essential to our work. It's the most almost essential piece, I think, in a lot of ways, right? I think working alongside RAP is definitely one of the biggest pleasures of my life and my profession. And, you know, obviously RAP is led by and composed almost entirely of people who are formerly incarcerated. And so, you know, I really see RAP as kind of the driving force in terms of what is our vision for change and what is our vision for a new system or a new structure. And there's so many other wonderful organizations we collaborate with, but RAP is our biggest friends and biggest partners.
They're pretty awesome.
Michelle, you have a really tough, frustrating job, truthfully. But there must be some rewards to it. And I wondered whether you could share with us a story or two of some things that have warmed your heart.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's true. I don't want to skip over the tough parts. I think it is important, you know, to say that the work is really hard. And a lot of people we work with die in prison or come home and die shortly after. And there's been a lot of loss and a lot of heavy and sad things that have happened in my time doing this work, and obviously long before, and there will be long after. But also, you're right, there's a lot of incredibly rewarding and special and wonderful things. The first thing that kind of comes to mind is somebody we worked with who I think would be very happy for me to say his name on air, Mark Shervington, who has been a longtime fan and listener of Law and
Disorder. Hello, Mark, if you're listening.
Hello, Mark. Mark was incarcerated for over 33 years on a 15-to-life sentence and was an incredible jailhouse lawyer while he was incarcerated, and is just a wonderful friend and ally of the project and has helped us so much in so many cases that we've worked on, and was really an advisor to the project before he actually even became an applicant of the project. And when Mark came home, we had just the deepest pleasure and honor of having him as a fellow at the project. And he was working for us part-time and working on an appeals manual. And, you know, Mark continues to this day to just be a very close friend and really an advisor to me and a mentor to me. He's, you know, my go-to person. Like, if I have a legal question, Mark is the person I call. I do not call another lawyer. Right. I call Mark. Right. So, yeah.
Who didn't go to law school.
No, no. I mean, but who essentially had, I think, much deeper education than I ever had in law school.
Well, Abraham Lincoln didn't go to law school either.
Michelle, we're all members of the National Lawyers Guild, and this project actually came out of the Guild. Tell us who some of your mentors were in law school and in the National Lawyers Guild.
I have so many mentors, so many people that have really guided me and taught me so much in this work. You know, in law school, I worked very closely with Steve Zeidman and continue to work very closely with him now on lots of parole issues and lots of other related work. And I call him every day when I have questions, and I'm very grateful to him. But within the Guild also, you know, there's a lot of young attorneys who really mentored me and got me started in this work. And Nora Carroll, who was, you know, in the Guild long before I was, and is really the reason I'm here, has been a mentor to me, and Scott Paltrowitz, and so many other people in the Guild, and so many jailhouse lawyers who are members of the Guild have been real mentors to me. And, you know, I think when I think about the people who have had the most impact on me and have really brought me up, you know, in a lot of ways, are people who are in prison or who have come home.
Yes.
Yeah, I owe them a lot.
Well, speaking of mentoring, what advice do you have for young law students or newly admitted attorneys who are interested in pursuing this kind of social justice work, but may find it daunting, either due to the political climate or feeling they are fighting a system in which it is difficult, if not impossible, to effect change?
Yeah, I think I would say to young attorneys, that I do think we all have a responsibility to do this work. I think that there is this sort of profound injustice that's happening around us every day. And, you know, sometimes I look around and I'm like, how are we not screaming at the rooftop saying, this is a crisis, this is urgent, this is so deeply important. And I would say to young attorneys, like, come get involved, come to our meetings, get trained in working with people in prison, create relationships with people in prison and people who have come home, try to defy and push back on your notions about violent crime, push back on your assumptions about people who have been in prison, and really try to integrate yourself into this work and talk to leaders who are formerly incarcerated about what their visions are and find ways for you to implement them. It doesn't necessarily mean practicing law in a certain way or in a specific way, but there's so much work to be done and there's so many ways for people to be involved.
Are you looking to involve more people? Is there a way that people can get a hold of you and learn more about your project and even become involved if they want to?
Absolutely. We have a new volunteer training coming up on April 3rd. We do those twice a year where we take about 50 to 100 volunteers and pair them with people who are incarcerated as they're preparing for parole. And people can find out about that by visiting our website at paroleprepny.org.
I will be at that training, by the way.
Great.
Michelle, something you said triggered a thought, and that is when a young person gets involved in the criminal justice system, perhaps through a stupid act, and you mentioned not wanting to define someone by the worst thing they've done, which I totally agree with, we know that the young mind, and that can go into one's 20s, is not formed, and that there can be rashness or circumstances that put someone in a situation they would not ordinarily be in. Do you work with a lot of individuals who committed their offense at a young age? And have you seen, is that argument about youth part of the process of application?
Yeah, it's actually such a relevant question right now. So I work with a lot of people who were convicted before the age of 18 or committed their crime before the age of 18. And, you know, there's been a ton of sort of movement, especially in the Supreme Court, around this question of what do we do with young people who are convicted of crimes and very violent crimes. And the New York State judiciary also has taken up this question and really said, you know, people who are convicted under the age of 18 or committed their crimes under the age of 18 are a special group of people. They are especially capable of transformation, especially capable of remorse, and that they weren't fully formed when they did the harm that they did. And so there has been a lot of sort of new protections that are developing and emerging for young people. You know, I think the question is the board going to abide by those regulations and by the sort of laws that are binding them? I think that's kind of to be seen. But I do think that there's a lot of movement and a lot of activation around this question of young people convicted of violent crime.
ParoleprepNY.org for people who want to perhaps volunteer or at least learn more about the good work you're doing. Do you have any final thoughts before we have to say goodbye?
No, just thank you so much for having me. And I hope everyone will just take a little time to do a tiny bit of research about people in prison and parole and issues affecting aging and elderly people. I think it's really important.
Very important, Michelle. And no one better to have at the helm of this work. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle. Very glad to start off the new year welcoming back political poet Raymond Nat Turner. Ray is currently the poet in residence at the Black Agenda Report, and he's been the guest opening act for such people as James Baldwin, Cynthia McKinney, David Zirin, and Congressman Barbara Lee. I crawled out of the house on a frigid night to hear you and Jazz Upsurge a couple of weeks ago. It was marvelous poetry and a terrific jazz quartet behind you. Now you're here a cappella. You've got a couple of poems to read to us, and we're very, very happy to have you here. What are you going to start off with?
Well, firstly, I'm going to start off by saying Happy New Year to the three of you, Jeff, Heidi, and you, Michael, and my dear Heidi, I'm really pulling for her speedy recovery when she's got all four limbs working independently. So that's my wish for her. What I have is, I've got a couple of pieces. One is called Three Words for Two EGs, and it's an elegy for Erica Garner, one of the young warriors who we lost very far, far too soon, in my opinion. Three words for two EGs. One, two, three. Three on one. Life hanging on tatted arms of a windpipe crushing Nazi thug. Three little words, 12 letters. 11 times. Not artful air escaping sides of a saxophonist's mouth. Song for her father. Fire breathing, bullhorn, blues shouter, drum major, marching, meeting, texting, tweeting, writing, raising roofs of consciousness. Standing up, sitting in, dying in, boycotting, blockading, refusing rest, chasing the fugitive, justice. One, two, three. Three on one. Not a broken bicycle pump or blacksmith's bellows. Three little words, 12 letters, 11 times. Not code talker, father to daughter. Membership in the club, wanting no new members. Club never giving her space to catch her breath. Know how it feels to breathe free. Instead of crying herself to sleep, listening for footsteps of justice. One, two, three. Three on one. Heart attack, asthma, cancer, coma. Her carry-ons, boarding nonstops, tearing her heart into 1,000 tender shards. 3 little words, 12 letters, 11 times. Code talker, daughter to father. Please put politicians' thoughts and prayers out with promises and dirty diapers.
Thank you, Raymond.
And then we go to something I dare not say a little lighter, but
less somber.
It is called Whoppers. I was really influenced. I've always loved the great Antonio Carlos Jobim and his Waters of March. And this is called Whoppers of Boss Tweet. A thief, a thug, clown in a rug, a tweet, deceit, a lie, a cheat, embellish, embroider, a lying disorder, a myth, a fable, a bit unstable, flim flam, clap trap, bunkum, bull crap, an empty wagon, a puffed up dragon, a whopper, a fib, you peep from your crib, a sham, a fake, a major mistake, pathological lying, false flag flying, a grope, a trope, bad jokes, breast strokes, a grope of a crotch, another man notch, where they debauch, over water and scotch, a trumped up story, cock and bull glory, a foot in the mouth, for strategy south, pie in the sky, a barefaced lie, a pig in disguise, fooling some eyes, playing fast and loose with Jim Jones juice, a masquerade, a Nazi parade, a fake great nation, same plantation, a bug in the hall, a fly on the wall, a great big whale, an ongoing tale, a parade in July, another big lie, a wink of the eye, enough outcry, a thief, a thug, man in a rug, a tweet, deceit, a lie, a cheat, time for feet in the street, sustaining street heat.
That's wonderful.
Bravo.
Thank you, Raymond.
That was
Nat
amazing.
Turner. Before you leave us, Ray, how can people get a hold of you and learn more about your poetry and your jazz group?
Upsurge Jazz, www.upsurgejazz.com. And if people want to reach me through email, that's upsurgejazz@gmail.com.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.